Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Peter DeLorenzo, episode number 157 for July 20th, 2012. Jawing with Joel Iwanek. So, Peter, man, it's been ages since I've seen you.
Yeah, it's been a while, right?
Jeez.
3 weeks?
Oh, more than that, I think, because I was on vacation.
Oh, yeah, I filled in for you, and then I missed the All-Star show. And
yeah. A lot going on in this industry, though.
Nah. Quiet.
Jeez. So what was this thing? I think you were the first one to dig it up, or first one I heard reporting it. The Nürburgring is in trouble.
I didn't dig it up, but yeah, they're in serious financial trouble. I guess they've got a 300 million euro note that they have to deal with, and they need an immediate infusion of cash to escape bankruptcy.
And what's the deal? Now, this is the old track and the new track, the whole complex thing?
Yeah, I think it includes everything.
Whoa, that just doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't. Well, I mean, it's the longest racetrack in the world, the Nordschleife, and it's awesome.
I've driven it.
Oh, it is just spectacular.
It's phenomenal.
I shot a general tire when they were introducing a high-performance tire way back when, and Jeff Swart came over at the same time to shoot some Pontiac commercials for us, or print ads and stuff. And so we had to run on the track for a week, and it was just spectacular. Not only that, I mean, besides going flat out all the time, I mean, NATO jets were doing their low-level flying maneuvers the whole time we were there. I mean, they were so low when they'd come over and bank because they were checking out, you know, they're trying to see what kind of cars were. You could see the markings on their helmets.
Wow.
Well, that's low.
That's close.
That's lower than air show low, you know. So, but it's a spectacular. I've told the readers of Auto Extremists and anyone I meet, you got to go there once. You got to see it. It's spectacular.
So what do you think is going to happen with the track?
I find it hard to believe that, you know, Germans are proud of their car industry.
And that track is iconic.
Yeah,
it's historic, especially the old track.
Yeah, something's got to give. I mean, but you don't know. I mean, if it's a privately owned enterprise, then maybe it will go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Then I don't know. What are the Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Porsche, and Volkswagen going to all chip in and own it? I mean, that's not that perfect.
That could happen.
Yeah.
That could definitely happen because it's used as such a test facility.
Yeah, yeah. So, too bad.
Yeah, I just got back from driving the Cadillac ATS. I can't talk about driving impressions. That's embargoed till next week, but pretty damn good car.
The product's impressive.
It's impressive on a number of levels. Number one, it's a clean sheet car. You know, this isn't badge engineered or warmed over whatever. It's a clean sheet design.
Number two, they added lightness, as Colin Chapman said.
Right. Yeah, it's now the lightest car in its segment. And, you know, General Motors, even though it makes good cars, damn if they aren't the heaviest cars in their segment. And now the ATS is the lightest in its segment. It's, if I'm doing the math right, 146 pounds lighter than a comparable 3 Series BMW, much more lighter than a C-Class Mercedes or an Audi A4. And it's not just like they threw a bunch of aluminum and magnesium in it, which they did, but it's really good engineering. They scalloped out all the flanges, steel flanges. So, I mean, they literally are cutting out steel where it's not needed. They've got lightning holes in the suspension members. They designed this thing so, for example, it's a 5-bar link rear suspension. All the links are straight. There's no bends or kinks or, you know, other attachment points to it. So, again, none of the stuff has got to be braced. It all attaches into the chassis in straight lines, so they don't need additional, you know, gussets or braces, and all that stuff keeps the weight down or adds lightness, as you say.
Well, yeah, you know, they did their homework, and because they have to, they're not on the radar screen in that segment at all.
Not at all.
And you know how that goes. I mean, Well, Joel will talk about this because they've got...
And we should announce because we got Joel Iwanek coming out later in the show. Yeah,
is the global marketing guru for General Motors. And the new campaign for the AT is fantastic. And, you know, they have to get some sort of recognition.
Right.
You know, before they even get consumer curiosity, they've got to get recognition.
Well, they tried it earlier, you know, with their art and science styling, and that worked, but it only went so far. The CTS, which really debuted that look, it's a very good car. But to be able to come out and say, we are the most mass-efficient car in the segment is a statement. And there's two other things, I want to talk about. The aerodynamics on this car, especially the underbody aerodynamics, is textbook example. I've never seen any car with so much attention to underbody aero detail, except in racing. They flipped the car on its side so we could take a look underneath it. And
tell them how they flipped the car.
Oh, this is a weird thing. I've never seen this before. You take two wheels off one side of the car.
Jack it up,
take two wheels off, and then they have, it almost looks like a gigantic one of those Formula One pit stop lift up the car.
Oh, yeah, Formula One jacks where they come in and they pull the nose up and pull the back up.
Right, but in this case, they pull two wheels off, they put up this jack thing, bolt it onto the wheels, and then one person... can pull the whole car up on its side.
So you can look at it.
It's awesome. We need one for the studio here. I'm telling you, it's almost as cool as the car itself.
Well, you know, this is, that's the old Porsche ad line, which I love to this day. It's everything we know so far. You know, and that...
I never heard that one.
Oh, yeah, it was my favorite Porsche line, besides there is no substitute. It is. I mean, the CTS-V and the Coupe and the ZR1, the Z06, those are show pony cars. They're fabulous. This is goes to the heart of the mainstream import intender, and they've got one shot. And so I'm glad to hear what you're saying. But I thought the dynamics would be great on the car as it was, but they did their homework.
No, they did their homework, and, you know, there's another story, too, in the powertrain, the new 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine, which is the base, and you think, what, a four and a caddy? No problem, guys, I'm telling you. And you should hear it at full throttle. Now, I cannot believe it was a four.
That's different from you can also get the Regal GS motor in it?
The 2-liter turbo,
right.
That's right. And it's at 272 horsepower, which GM is claiming, and I don't have any reason to doubt it, it's the most power-dense engine in the industry.
Well, that's what they claim with the Regal GS. I mean, I think it's the same horsepower, 2 horsepower better than the GS's. Mm-hmm. I think it's 270.
Right. And then there's the 3.6-liter V6 with, I think it's 320 horsepower.
But I wouldn't get that motor.
No, I wouldn't either. They pretty much know the Turbo 4 is...
So what's the new motor below the Regal GS motor again? It's 2.5?
It's a 2.5, naturally aspirated, but all the bells and whistles, dual VVT, direct injection, blah, blah, blah. And it sounds so good.
Wow.
At full throttle, it does not sound like a four-cylinder engine. It sounds almost like a mini V8. Almost. Not quite, but almost.
Cool.
So, you know, mass efficient, incredible detail to aero, especially underbody aero, terrific powertrain. They finally, it's a no-excuses car. You can't say, yeah, it's good, but. No, it's just, well, actually, there is one but. It's a 6-speed automatic. And my guess is this is one of the casualties of going through the bankruptcy, developing the car in bankruptcy. You know, to be fully, totally, completely competitive, it really should have an 8-speed automatic right now.
Right.
And I'll bet it does before too long.
But there's an engineer that doesn't live far from where I am, and he's had a black ATS at his house for 2 weeks. And I drive by it, look at it. You know, I think I've changed a little bit. I wasn't too thrilled about the look of the car in the front.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it's a little, I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I see the new XTS coming down the road aimed at you, it's just like, wow, that looks good.
I've seen two out on the street, XTS. It's the bigger one, and it does look good on the street.
Yeah, and the ATS is much better in real life than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good, because Mark Rice was yelling at me via email one time. So, Mark, if you're watching and listening, yeah, it looks pretty good. It looks better than I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you really got to see it back to back with some of the other cars in its class out there too.
They had them lined up.
No, they didn't. They had the media intro in Atlanta. So just driving out on the street, you know, I'm checking out every C class and 3 series that I can just to sort of gauge what I think about the styling. I think it's decent. You know, I actually still think the CTS Coupe is the best one out there.
I think the CTS Coupe is going to be one of those designs with longevity for many, many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
But we should talk more about this when we get Joel on,
yeah,
too. So what else? Anything else going on out there that...
Well, my column this week talked about the need for... General Motors is sorely lacking a proper museum. I mean, the Corvette Museum is not affiliated with the company. I mean, they have a wonderful working arrangement, but it is not an official museum. I mean, you have these palaces that Volkswagen, Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Porsche have built. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that, but that's image wrangling at its highest level. They just say, why are we going to spend $55 million or $80 million or $100 million on this, because it is a huge brand statement.
And now, they do have the Heritage Center.
They have the Heritage Center.
It's not open to the public.
No, you can rent it. It's an 81,000-square-foot facility, and you go in, and, yeah, there's some great cars. I mean, just a fraction of the cars GM has, you know, stowed away everywhere. But, you know, it's too bad. I mean... you know, I think, besides the fact Iacocca, you know, went over from Ford and resurrected Chrysler and all that, I think Iacocca's biggest legacy to me is that he had the foresight when Chrysler was flush with cash to say, you know, this Highland Park thing isn't working out. And I used to present advertising there, and I can tell you that was like, boy, I can't even.
It was 80 years too old.
Oh, man. So he had, you know, he had the cash, and he said, we need a new idea. And they bought all that property in Auburn Hills, and they built that technical center with design there and engineering and their executive office, everything. And to me, that's his biggest legacy. Now, you know, Dan Ackerson has, you know, a lot on the plate. And as I put out in my column, this is the very last thing. It's not even on his radar screen. And, you know, short term, probably shouldn't be. But it would be a wonderful legacy if he was the guy, other than the CEO immediately after the bankruptcy, because that's all it is right now. If he was the guy who put into motion to get a proper General Motors Museum built. And, you know, come on. Now, the Henry Ford is not officially affiliated with Ford Motor Company, but who's kidding who? I mean, you know, it's...
It is, but, you know,
it's a
most of the product in there, the car stuff,
is not
Ford. Ford.
But, you know, GM, you can imagine the cars they could have.
Oh, the Heritage Center, which both you and I have been into a number of times, it's fantastic. And as you point out, they can't even exhibit everything that they have.
No, I think that it's not even, it's like one-tenth of the cars they have.
And they, remember, during the bankruptcy, they broomed out a whole bunch of cars.
Yeah, sold some.
I know, but what's left is the best of the best of the best. And I don't mean just in good condition. This is the rarest of the rarest stuff that GM has ever built in its history.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and some readers wrote, oh, GM isn't building. Come on, you know, step back. You know, this is a company, a transportation icon of the world. And it deserves... you know, it's a showcase. GM's not a... Yeah, I know GM's not a brand, but you can't have a Chevrolet museum and leave Oldsmobile out, yeah, or Pontiac or Buick or anything else. So, yeah, get over yourselves. It's going to be a GM museum, or it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope someday they're financially strong enough to do it.
No, I hope so, too. And
because it's going to be $100 million.
Sure, and things disappear if you don't do that, because, interestingly... On this ATS trip, I was talking with some GM engineers, and they were lamenting the fact that a lot of powertrain history went, I mean, I think it ended up in the scrapyard. Maybe, hopefully, somebody grabbed onto a history of engine developments that...
I mean, you can imagine, yeah. I mean, think about the V16 Cadillacs and all the stuff that GM did. you know, maybe some things, maybe actual displays from the Motorama they could recreate, because the Motorama was one of the most influential car shows of any kind in automotive history. Mm-hmm. So they've got, you know, it would be fantastic. And they could even do, you know, they could do a whole thing on racing, and they could do the whole thing about how GM didn't really officially approve of racing, but then they could have, you know, they could, Jim Hall could lend the Chaparrals, they could lend the Grand Sport Corvettes, they could have all this stuff in there and tell the real story, you know. Anyway.
Anyway.
It's not high on their list.
Maybe you will help make that so.
Yeah.
Hey, let's take our first commercial break and let's get Joel Iwanek on here. So, Carmen, let's go with our first break. So, everybody, we got Joel Iwanek on here with us.
Hi, guys.
Joel is the...
Is this on the record, by the way?
No, you can spill your guts
with
no
so
worries.
Lately, I'm just like, okay, I just need to know, is it on the record or not?
Well, this is called After Hours, but yeah, it ends up in the podcast is watched by a lot of people, listened to by a lot of people.
All over the world. All
I'm
over the
so
world.
Excited about that.
Folks, Joel is the global guru. He's the wizard of all marketing for General Motors. Oh, but Joel, tell us your long, strange trip to get to GM. Oh, give us some of your stops, because that's pretty interesting.
So you're talking about Nissan? Is that what you're getting at?
Not that. Well, that was a cup of
even
coffee.
Even before that.
That was a cup of coffee, yeah. No, yeah, I found the bathroom. I knew where that was.
That was a cup of coffee. No, I'm talking about, you know, Porsche and your other stuff.
Hey, thank you so much. So, you know, I did 10 years at Porsche, 1989 to 1999.
You were the marketing director?
Yeah, I would say, if I recall, 8 of the 10 years I was there, I was the head of marketing. I went there, and it was kind of a weird start. I got there, and I got hired and worked for a guy named Brian Bowler, if you remember Brian.
I remember.
Great marketing guy. He ran DDB, had the Volkswagen account many years. Ellie Gargano before that, if I'm not mistaken. But now we're going back in time.
Yeah.
And so I worked with him, and the guy I went to work for was the head of Lexus advertising agency for a while. He didn't last long. He was like a couple months. And so I was up there by myself, and this guy who hired me, so they turned to me, and we were in a terrible time, and a guy named Rich Ford, of all people, and he was a great mentor for me. Worked for him for better part of 10 years. Came out of Ford here, worked 20 years at Ford, 10 years at Toyota, and the last part of his career, he was at Porsche. Great guy. So that was 10 years. Lived in Reno, Nevada, of all places.
Yeah, oh, I was still out there.
I remember this is the days when they wanted to bring the cars in by 747s.
Right.
Land them, take them apart, put them together at 2 PDI centers, one in South Carolina, one in Reno, and then deliver the cars from there. The funny thing is they did it once, and they figured out it cost $400,000 to send the plane back empty. Somebody got fired. I was like, they tried to find anything they could to take something back to Germany, put the holes in these planes. Never did find anything. That ended. Like two flights, and that was all they did.
Yeah, the Reno thing didn't make sense. And then, but that's where you met Pat Fallon.
Yes. Pat was our agency when I first started there.
And when Joel went to General Motors, he drafted Pat to come on board with Cadillac. But so that was...
He was the agency for about 2 years, and then we brought on Goodby after that.
So from Porsche to where?
And then from Porsche, I ended up moving to Atlanta with Porsche. We moved, took 16 people or 20 people with us from Reno to Atlanta, brought in a whole new staff there and did that for 2 or 3 years. And then I got recruited to go work in the yachting industry. So I worked for a company called Palmer Johnson. You probably guys...
I know.
Palmer Johnson makes mega yachts, 200-footers, all the way down the smaller boats. It was a great experience and helped them actually sell that company. And in the process, I met some guys, a guy named Bill Bain and Ralph Willard, who had bought a boat company. Bill Bain is Bain Capital. They had an employee named Mitt Romney working
so
for
heard.
Them. Yeah, so it's kind of a funny association. And then I did that for a few years and then ended up getting back into Hyundai. Through a consultancy thing that I did. I helped them write a brand strategy for Kia and Hyundai, and that was a fun process. And then spent 7 years working on Hyundai.
Making noise, pissing people off.
All the time. Our job is not a popularity contest, is it? You know,
No.
At the end of the day,
hey, I'm curious. I think Hyundai and Kia are headed for internal trouble in the sense that, you know, Hyundai bought Kia, They had been fierce competitors against each other. They're still fierce competitors against each other. And now Kia's starting to slowly catch up to Hyundai, which has got to piss the Hyundai guys off to no end. And I'm just curious, from your vantage point, have these two brands really carved out separate identities for each other that'll go forward a long term?
Yeah, they have a plan, and they're working the plan. And that tension that you're talking about is by design. They actually managed that tension, I think, quite well and to their benefit. They're a very, very fierce competitor, and they have two different identities. You're going to see, you know, over time, you're going to see Hyundai become a little bit more refined, a little bit more upscale, and Kia is going to be a little bit more the fun, right? And that's their plan long term, and they've had this plan for a while, and they're working the plan, and the products are coming to back that up. What they did to alleviate some of the internal tension, that first there was just Kia guys who came with the company with Kia, and then there was just Hyundai guys. And you're correct, they at first didn't get along. So one of the ways they, you know, the remedy to that was they put E.S. Chung, who's the son of the chairman, put him in charge of Kia for many years. And by doing so, they made it legitimate to be at Kia. And then they took some Kia executives from Hyundai, put them at Kia, and they took vice versa, they took Kia executives and put it in Hyundai. So they kind of did this. Yes.
Yeah.
And in doing so, that started to bring the companies together. But they always want that tension. When I was here just in North America working on it, it was part of the plan to have us not get along. There was healthy tension between us and a competitive nature between us. We got together for a couple things. Media buying, when we, you know, we looked at the upfronts for auto shows, you know, looking at how we were going to buy the space at auto shows, things like that. After that, I mean, it was literally, I'm going to go try to kick your butt now and see you later. And they wanted it that way. And that was less so at the Korean level and more so at the, you know, the American level, American staff level. But I think it was a healthy thing. And there's a lesson in there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of like the old days. Buick hated Pontiac and Pontiac hated Chevrolet. And they all wanted to kick each other's teeth in, and they grew all together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then around the world, that's true basically everywhere they go. And they manage it really well at a corporate level. They're managing that tension. Mm-hmm. And when it gets out of hand, they step in, and when it's not, they like it.
So speaking of tension, you stopped at Nissan for, as we said, a cup of coffee, which was literally 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then you journeyed to the Silver Silos.
Yeah, it was an interesting couple weeks. I will say that when I went in, Carlos Tavares was at the time the man running the place. And I went in and I said, look, I just got this call from Mark Royce. And I feel, you know, a certain obligation to take this job. It's kind of, you got to remember back 2 years ago, we were still in a very odd place. The country was economically, the company was. And I felt this sense of duty to do this thing. And I went to explain it. And I remember Carlos going, if it was any other company, I'd be angry with you. This one, I get it.
Really?
I've seen him. It was he's a really good at what he does, by the way. If you don't know who he is, he's quite.
Well, he's probably going to take over Renault, isn't he?
He is. He's running Renault. It's probably bigger things than that. He's very, very talented and very, very good manager.
When
and good
Carlos
executive.
Decides to step aside.
He's quite good. But he was very gracious and completely understanding. And the transition was perfect. And quite frankly, I didn't have to say it, but I did. I knew quite a bit about the Leaf, obviously, at this point. And, you know, I never divulged anything I knew ever. And he knew I wouldn't. And it was a very professional situation. I really admire him.
No kidding. Quite a bit. That's highly unusual.
It was. But in this situation, he'd lived in America for a while. He understood the situation, and he understood exactly the relationship I had with Mark Royce at that point. And I still have a really great relationship with him, and obviously have a great relationship with Mark, and I have unbelievable respect for both.
So you blew up the ad agencies. You brought your old cohorts in, Jeff Goodby and mm-hmm. Pat Fallon.
First week I was here.
Yes. And how's it gone? I mean, really, I know it's been tough because you first had to deal with the bureaucracy that was in place at General Motors there's an overall bureaucracy, then there's a marketing bureaucracy, and you know, I know you had a tough time. And how do you think it's been? It's gone since.
You know, I had high expectations and a pretty demanding to make this work. We don't have time to waste around getting this agency up and running. And every day you waste time doing this, you're not doing something you're supposed to be doing. And I think it's gone better than I expected. And the reason why is because at the end of the day, when you hire an agency, you're really hiring the creative abilities of the people and the talent at those agencies. And because Jeff Goodby already had a strong relationship with Washington down in Sao Paulo, and they were friends for many years and known each other for a couple decades, and Parsoon in Mumbai, and Linus that was going to handle Europe, because they already had a relationship, there was a lot of that getting to know each other you didn't have to do. So they were able to come together and start working, establishing plans, and who was going to work together, and who. And I kind of anointed Jeff kind of the pseudo driver of the bus, the leader of the creative.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves. I think we skipped over a few steps. But, you know, you brought in Jeff to run Chevrolet and Pat to run Cadillac.
Cadillac, yeah.
Their agencies. And then as you progressed, I think Dan asked you, you know, because Dan was asking for savings throughout the company.
Sure.
He said, what can you do? And then... That's what you were referring to. He brought Jeff in and some other people from McCann to build a new...
Commonwealth.
Yeah. And threw a name on it. And then this is now your latest thing to wrangle Chevrolet around the world.
Yep. And it's
a huge
it's working.
Task.
It is. It's working. And it's working because on our side, we need to look at our organization. But the people on our side realized we needed to do this. That we had inefficiencies throughout the organization, and now we had a way to find a remedy for those inefficiencies. And I think the AC situation is going to grow and get better and better and better, but I think it's beyond my expectations now, and it's going quite well, and the teamwork is good. And on this, honestly, on the media side, it's gone really well, way better than we thought. So far, so good. And does that mean we won't have a hiccup from time to time? Yeah. But I think on both the client side, our side, and on the AC side, we are anticipating those and trying to find ways around them as soon as they happen. So, we have a weekly governance board now. I mean, we're doing some cool things. Everybody's got their iPads. Wherever they are traveling in the world, you tune in to these meetings. I run them. They take about an hour. We go through whatever the issues are, and we're off. And all the key people from all over the world, we can actually see each other now rather than the stupid phone, and you can do it wherever you are. I've done one from the plane.
Cool. Video linked?
Yeah, because you can, I don't know if they don't really like it when you're on the plane and you're doing the, you know, talking on your iPad, but it, you know, if you have to, you have to. Lufthansa gets a little nervous about it, but it's okay. They start thinking you're a spy or some kind of terrorist or something.
So John, you know, just drove the ATS and spent time with it. And I have to say that, you know, it's no secret that your friend Pat and his agency was been on a little shaky ground.
Yeah.
You know.
Are we all?
Yeah, we're all. And,
with the Cadillac kind.
Yeah, with the Cadillac stuff. I mean, it's tough. It's, if you've been in the ad business, it's tough. It really is tough. But I have to say the ATS campaign is going to do exactly what you want it to do. I mean, this is, I've written about it on the site. I think it's getting notice. It's your first objective. I mean, you're not on the radar screen. You have to do that, and I think this campaign.
Talk about the campaign. Peter was telling me a little bit about it before the show because I haven't seen any of this, but what's it all about?
So it starts with product, always product. And we're fortunate, and I think it's something that we're very proud of is the car that the engineers gave us because they were given the opportunity to build something from the ground up, not a derivative one of some other architecture. And with that, you get what you're talking about, the lightweight car, right? If you had to start with something else, would there be compromises throughout the car? But in this case, there isn't, you know? And they did that with the purpose of beating the 3 Series, right? Going out and building a car that actually could compete and beat that car. And they benchmarked the last generation, the previous generation, then the new generation. Then they went back and said, well, we see some changes they made from the previous generation. Then they went to look at the old generation again and kept making the changes necessary that we think we finally have a product that actually, you know, 3 decades, how many companies have tried? You tell me, how many companies have tried to take this car on and actually really take that and push that car and become an alternative to the 3 Series? And, you know, I think we finally have something. That we have the goods that we can do that. You drove it.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to. You heard me at the beginning of the show. I'm really impressed by the car.
Yeah, I think once people start to learn more about the car, and it's going to start happening next week, you start to tell that we really have something. And what we want to do from a marketing standpoint, when you have that kind of product, is you want to create that kind of dialogue, that tension where people are debating. Well, I don't think it's better than the 3 Series. I think the 3 Series is this. But for us to get into that conversation, that is our goal. To cause that kind of tension, that kind of conversation, that debate. And that's what that campaign is supposed to do. It's supposed to cause people to look at Cadillac differently and also start considering this ATS. And if we've done our job well, we're going to force the consumer who's in that segment to have to consider this car. They may not do it, but they're going to have to talk about it. And that's what we need to do to start building that kind of market share that we have in that segment. Look at, to be honest with you, it's 400,000 units sell in that segment. It's the biggest segment, the luxury car segment around the world and in industry around the world. And in the United States, the 3 Series BMW has 25% market share. They own it, right? Next is the C, and they get about, call it 75,000 units. So they're doing very well. Between the two of them, we want to get into that mix. That's going to be a challenge. I'm not telling you it's easy.
So tell us about the campaign. What are you doing to get people talking about the car?
So we took a little bit, you know, for those, this is kind of an inside thing. So we took a page out of the campaign that Lexus used in the late 80s, early 90s, the demonstration campaign. And you say to yourself, why did that work? What was the purpose and the goal behind that? Well, they were trying to get into the consideration set. Very analogous to what we're doing against the Germans.
And if you don't remember that campaign, that was the one with the champagne glasses but on the hood, the ball bearing running down the seam of the car.
Gold-tipped connector, that campaign. Yeah. So you started talking about those kinds of features in a way that was relevant to that customer so that they would have the ammunition so to back that up, the positive ammunition they're going to need when they pull that car in their driveway and their neighbor asks them, why did you do this? Or if their neighbor, the other three in the foursome, starts asking, why did you do that? They get the positive affirmation for, oh, I get why you did that. I've heard about this, Lex. We have the same situation with this car going into a segment that's been dominated by the Germans for many years. So we designed the campaign to talk about those features, but in a modern iteration of that, in an interesting way that also projects the brand as a global car, because we plan on selling this car around the world. This is the car that's going to open us up to a European customer we could have never talked to before. Obviously, in China, we're going to sell this car. So this gives us a world platform for us to talk about this brand in ways we had never done before. And I've said it before, we need to start looking with Cadillac. We need to look beyond Jefferson Avenue. Right? We've, for many, many years...
Look beyond Detroit.
Detroit. And, you know, that's difficult, but the engineers did it. They gave us a product that allows us to do that. You know, and I got to tell you, Mark Royce has a lot to do with this car. I mean, let's just be straight. I mean, he was heavy-handed pushing the engineers to do that, to look beyond here. Lots of testing at the Nürburgring, lots of testing around the world. So we picked 4 locations. We went down to Patagonia. Patagonia is known for being the windiest place on Earth. And it's also a very exotic place to go, an interesting place to go, and interesting people live there.
So you shot the car there.
America. We shot the car in Guangzhou Mountains of China, which is a very interesting place. Again, it's the home of Kung Fu, by the way, just by chance. We went to Monaco, and we were able to get on the F1 track and actually drive on the track. And very few people have been able to do that.
During the race weekend.
During the race on the track, not just on the street, but during the, you know, when they have the track set up. And then we went to Morocco into the Atlas Mountains and went to a road that there are, you know, 100 switchbacks in less than 3 miles. And it's just enormous stresses that are put on the car. And we use these exotic locations, these roads, to demonstrate the magnetic, You had the suspension, right?
Yeah.
The magnetic rides.
Rheology, yeah.
And the Brembo brakes we did in the Atlas Mountains. And the lightweight construction helped us show how the agility of the car on the racetrack. So we use these locations.
In the quiet cabin. For
quiet cabin in. Down. So we used these interesting locations to tell the story about the car, bring people into it. And once we did, we know going forward, a 30-second commercial doesn't do it anymore. This customer is going to dig deeper. They're going to be looking at your brand. They're going to be looking at your product, and then they're going to get more engaged. So we then told the story behind the making of the commercials. We have some really interesting people that were involved in it. And then beyond that, we told stories of the locations. The one that we find the most interesting, the test of it, was the story of the driver and the narrator going into the school where they teach 35,000 kids kung fu. And how these kids go through this. So there's ways, different ways to get to the brand, different interesting stories around it. And I think as you go through, you find that we tell a story. And there's lots of chapters in this story. We have 8 commercials that we're going to use during the Olympics. After that, there's more commercials coming. There's actually 4 30-minute segments that we're going to make a documentary about the making of and the behind the scenes. That at first, we were just going to put on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And now we're getting interest from some networks that liked it so much that we actually may turn it into a little mini-series on some network as well. So that's what going forward, that's what you have to do when you launch a new car like this and you have to engage in multiple levels and beyond just the test drives. You got to get them to come in, and especially when it's a Cadillac. We have a bigger hurdle to jump with this segment, with these customers, and quite frankly, the competition's pretty good, about as good as it gets. You'll see more about it. It breaks next week on the 27th. You know,
is this going to go global too?
And it's eventually, yes, as we go forward and as we roll the car out globally, you'll see this stuff go global. Be honest, we're really proud of our engineers, but you also should be proud of our engineers, that they're demonstrating when they get the opportunity, when the company gets its footing and its financial systems together, it shows you what they can do. The Bolt was an example of it. Now you got this ATS. This is an example of what can be done here in America, here in Detroit, with American engineers and take on the world. Kind of exciting, actually, to be part of it.
How do you keep it going? Because, Peter, you've talked a lot about this, you know. Car companies will get out, a new launch, boom, blow all this advertising, and then psh, nothing for the next 3 years after that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, we are investing significant. I won't tell you the dollars, but this is a significant amount of money that's going behind the ATS launch, and it's as much or more than what our competition would spend to launch a car like this, because we know we have a bigger hurdle. We've damaged the Cadillac brand over the years by starting and stopping and bringing cars in that didn't deserve the Cadillac badging. We know we have those issues to deal with. We're not stupid. We see it. This had to be done right, and we have to really use this car as a way to introduce a whole new customer base to Cadillac, right? This is going to bring in people that our dealers have not seen before. And they know that, and they're prepared for that, and they know it's coming. There's been a lot of training around this, but they're going to get customers they haven't seen before. And that's what we want. This is our conquest opportunity, and this is the way we're going to bring new people, younger people, into our brand. We have to. It's the only way you're going to grow this brand.
Right.
Really,
you know, if you grow the brand right, it can make a lot of money for the company.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and not just here but around the world.
Right. So let's go to the other end, Chevrolet.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got almost an equal kind of a challenge in taking that brand global, right?
You know, but it's going quite well. I mean, the one of the things that we end up talking quite a bit about what happens here in North America, but you should know that the first half of this year, we just closed the first 6 months of this year, this calendar year. It was the best sales half we've ever had in the history of Chevrolet in 100 years. And you go back, keep beating previous goals. We've had 12 consecutive quarters of growth, record growth. And that's even with, honestly, that's even with last month's sales slowing down. The June sales slowed down a little bit because of Europe and other markets around the world. And even with that, we still were able to set that record. And with the factories that are open, with all the new launches we have around the world, we're actually pretty optimistic about the second half of this year as well for Chevrolet globally. But we're up against competition in markets all over the world. You know, I run into the guys from Hyundai everywhere I go. I run into the guys from Volkswagen everywhere, and we all know each other now. You know, we see each other. And I got to tell you, Hyundai is taking on Brazil and sees Brazil as an opportunity, and their spending, their investment spending there, like you've never seen before. And no one's writing about it, and no one sees it. We get... But I think that if you ask other car executives, they're looking, they are after Brazil. And we have 17, 18% market share down there. We enjoy a really healthy relationship with our dealers. We've been down there for 95 years. We have manufacturing down there. I'm not sure the Brazilians have a stronger love affair with Chevrolet than even Americans do. That's how strong that relationship. And thank God, because we didn't invest in the product down there like we should have, and now we've just turned over the entire product lineup. By the end of this year and into the next couple quarters of next year, everything will have been turned. And you see the new pickup truck is doing very well down there. As a matter of fact, the only problem we have is our loyal customers that have been buying our pickup truck down there, we're not able to satisfy them because we're holding it for consumer needs, not for agricultural needs. And so eventually we'll catch up, but... It's healthy situation down in Brazil for us now, but up against huge competition. And the announcement last week, you might have caught it, Volkswagen's going to bring the up down there, decontented up down there. That's going to be tough competition again. I mean, you're seeing this not only there, you see it in India, you see it in Thailand. But we took the new truck, the new Colorado is being launched with a great diesel engine in Thailand. And here's a market where, quite frankly, Toyota's owned it. They've owned it since, the late 50s, and, after World War II. They went in there and they were strong. We're finally going after them with a truck that we think competes. And it's exciting to see what's happening down there because we have a diesel. We have a nice car that's in their market.
Interesting listening to you talking about all these different countries, because it caused quite a stir in this country when you announced that Chevrolet was going to be sponsoring Manchester United,
yeah,
soccer team in,
yeah,
England. I don't think it probably got that kind of play in the rest of the world, but everybody here was shocked. What do you mean Chevrolet sponsoring a soccer team?
Yeah. It's football, by the way.
Well, I know.
It's only soccer here.
Yeah, it ain't
right.
Football, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's the NFL you're talking about. No, so, yeah, we're having to teach a whole new language to people here in America. But honestly, what that is that's a signal of us operating differently. So in the past, the monies needed to do that would have come out of our operations in Europe. And they would have looked at it and said, oh, we can't afford to do that. We're too small in Europe to do that. So there's chicken and the egg syndrome going on there. We step back. We have a global budget now that we can use to go do these things that we know that will build the brand in markets all over the world that Europe couldn't have done on their own. But the actual benefit to us is stronger in China and in Asia, where they have a huge fan base. So if you don't know it, they have 800 million people who claim to be fans of the club. It is probably the most successful, largest athletic club, sports franchise.
The three largest sports franchises are Manchester United, the New York Yankees, and the Dallas Cowboys.
Yes. Yeah.
Huh. Manchester United is worth $2.4 billion. The Yankees are worth $1.8 billion, and I think Cowboys are worth $1.6 billion or something.
Yeah. And more important, so there's what they want to do, and their objectives of building a stronger fan base in North America and us wanting to build, a higher brand awareness and build our brand outside of North America, our two strategies came together, and it's really a win-win for us. And they were with Audi before, and Audi wasn't really taking advantage of the relationship like they should. I'll just give you one example, and this is just one way that I know marketers understand when I say, from the Super Bowl, we generated over 600 million impressions, and that was a lot of work. That was, 7 months in the making. Super Bowl is the biggest thing that happens here in the United States, and that was a good number. We're very happy with that. That's one of the things we use to look at ROI in terms of our investment there. When we did just the press announcement, I did one in the Ren Center downtown here, and then there was one simultaneously happening in Shanghai at the same time. the measurement came back after 24 hours.
Of which announcement now?
Of the Manchester United mm-hmm. announcement that we announced our relationship, and it's just a simple sponsorship.
Yeah, you don't have logos.
We don't have logos on the shirts. We just put their logo in their chair. We have some advertising on the field. We're doing some other things with them around the world that are promotional activities. So it's a real small play, actually. There were 1 billion impressions as measured by RPRA.
Just on the press release.
Yes, just
Jeez.
On the press release. And that shows you the scale we're going to get out of this. And the nice thing is that's just the start. We're going to sponsor a tour they're going to have here in North America and then down to Brazil. We're right now sponsoring this week. There's one in South Africa, which is brought to you by Chevrolet. It's going to go to Sweden. It's in China. The television eyeballs on the simple little friendly match they're going to have in China is like 300 million people. I went to a match. So I went, Super Bowl happened here, right? Audience was, I think, 115 million when it peaked, somewhere in that ballpark. The following Sunday, I was at their facility watching a match between Liverpool and it's just a league match, just a Premier League match. When we got the numbers back that following Monday after that, it was 250 million people just for a league match. So you start to see the scale and the opportunity we could do. And this is just one thing we're looking at around the world. But it's a way that you're going to start seeing us be able to operate differently. I know it's a simple thing. Others have been doing it for a while. Hyundai's pretty good at this. Mm-hmm. Their global sponsorships are pretty strong, and they've been doing a good job. But if you look, we just had the best first half we have. We've had record sales around the world, and we're just getting started, right? We're really starting to look at marketing opportunities just now. When we get our pace going, we start managing this globally in a more effective way, you're going to start to see that growth happen. And so the question comes, did you take dollars out of North America to do this? No, actually, we didn't. Actually, we're raising our investment in North America here in the United States. Our football spend is going to be up. We didn't take money away from the NFL. These are dollars that we were able to pool together from all the other markets and use collectively to make this thing happen. And that's just the beginning. But it's just a different way of us marketing. And this was Dan Ackerson's vision way back when, as he's looking at these brands. And you'll start to see that more with Chevrolet, and then you'll start seeing it more and more as time goes on. You'll see it with Cadillac and the other regional brands as well.
So are you going to stay with Chevy Runs Deep?
As of right now, it's believe it or not, it's starting to take off in other parts of the world organically. I was at a concert in India, and the woman knew I was there. Of course, she knew I was there, and it was a pretty big concert, thousands of people. And she started saying, "And Chevy runs deep." Repeat after me, "Chevy runs deep." And they were all doing it. So I'm in a concert in India, and the woman's doing it. So it's starting to take off, and we're starting to put the meaning behind it. It started a little slow in here in North America because we're going through our centennial, so much of it seemed to be attributed back to our heritage. And as soon as we started taking it off our heritage and really talking about the deeper meaning that we want to have with Chevy and our customers and what we mean by celebrating the everyday hero, it's starting to get some traction. I have no anticipation of killing it right now, but I will tell you, as we try to go around the world, we will look at either taking that around the world globally or we'll look at something else. But I do think long-term, it's best if we have one message and one idea around the world. But it has to be something that's relevant and resonates with consumers everywhere. We don't want to just have some kind of corporate, you know, statement. It's got to be something that brings the customer into the relationship with us. That's the ones that work the best.
So, John, speaking of our next sponsor message,
I think we ought to go to it right now because it's entirely appropriate with the guest we have on today's show.
Oh, what is it?
Carmen, let's run it.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
So you were talking, there's a good story behind this ad?
Yeah, this is a letter that was sent to the true story of that actual ad. The guy sent that in. He saw Chevy Runs Deep, by the way. That's where this came from. He said, you know, I've got my Chevy Runs Deep story. So thank you for setting it up. And that's where this came from, is this true story about this guy tracking down his father's car. And, you know, we brought these people to the LA Auto Show, brought tears to a bunch of people's eyes. But this is the relationship that we're talking about that people have with the car that, quite frankly, some other manufacturers don't have. So we need to take advantage of it. It's going with the pitch, if you will. So.
Okay, yeah. Well, now we got to get to the part where our audience gets to ask you some questions, too.
Is this on the record, too?
Oh, no, this is not on the record.
There's nobody paying attention.
Oh, no, this is deep background. You can say whatever you want.
Okay.
Carmen, let's go to rapid fire. Let's bring that up. Okay, here we go. Prehistoric says GM needs to bring the ATS to the Amelia Island Concours for free test drives against Jag, Mercedes, BMW, Rover.
Stay tuned. It's going to happen. That's one that's it's on our list. It's funny. I had a conversation with Ed Wilburn about that this morning, and that's one of his favorite places. But, yep, that's on our list. That's where you go, right?
That's on our list to go, too, John.
Yeah. No, I think it'd be really cool for us to be sponsored to go down there. Right.
Oh, thank you very much.
Probably make that happen. Can we make that happen?
Hopefully Bill's listening. Yeah. Mitch W. says, could you ask Mr. Rawanek what GM is learning about young people? What are cars in their lives? I don't watch much TV or read papers, magazines, newspapers. How do you reach me?
So this is a great story, and we're pretty excited about the efforts our team is putting together to reach a younger audience. And a good story about that is the Sonic. When we launched the Sonic last fall, the first 4 or 5 months, we had no television advertising. The first ad we ran was in the pregame of the Super Bowl last year. And I have to be honest with you, when we first started talking about this, I was quite nervous about not having some TV to back up the launch of this car, because it was happening all socially. It was all happening on the internet, on Facebook, on YouTube, on various websites that we had built and set up. And the entire launch happened through a social launch. And what we did is we went out and found out about millennials, what they're interested in, some music, doing things that were first, bungee jumping, jumping out of an airplane, doing flips and things like this, things that were quite risk-oriented, but something that were exhilarating and interesting and something that they were into. So we put the car through those same paces, built those kind of stunts and events, and that's how we launched the car, all through this. And to me, a personal learning was, this is showing me the future of how the launch cars and how marketing is going to be done, because we can successfully, and as of right now, I believe we're still the leader in retail sales in that segment, and we have had very little television advertising to this point for that car. That shows us that marketing in the automotive industry is going to change, is changing, has changed. Social's a big part of it. Facebook's a big part of it. YouTube. This is how the future is going. As a matter of fact, we talk about that audience doesn't relate to the 30-second commercial like my generation did. And it's almost not necessary. And when you start seeing that evolution, the power of a 30-second commercial is diminishing. Right, it works great in the Super Bowl. It works great in 10 events. But over time, you need to be prepared for that question and for that. So our team's learning. We've hired a bunch of young people in our place. And I tell you what, they cause chaos for some of the older generation. But that's what we need. We need that healthy tension. And we need to force that tension internally. And we'll get more work like the Sonic.
Speaking of Facebook, you caused a lot of controversy saying, hey, it's not worth having advertising on there. That all blew up. And now it seems like you're backtracking a bit on that.
No. Backtracking.
Facebook is backtracking.
I'm not backtracking. But it's unfortunate the way that all came out. And I still feel terrible about the way it came out, the timing of that. A great reporter asked me a good question. And in the process of a broad interview that I did, it was like a 4-hour interview, we answered that question. But it was really more about the fact that we're looking at every part of our marketing, our spend, and we're turning everything upside down and doing those things. And it came out through that. So I feel bad about that. Do I think that we'll eventually be back advertising? We spend a ton of money on Facebook now, really a lot of money. And we could do a better job than we're doing, because we're always trying to learn and do better. And the Sonic was one way that we learned from that, and next time we'll even do better. But advertising, maybe someday. We're always talking to them about how to do that and how to do it better. They're good folks, and we'll figure it out, I'm sure. Someday we'll do something.
Bill wants to know, are you guys, meaning me and Peter, going to do another show from the Woodward Dream Cruise?
I hope
yes,
so.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
We're definitely going
to
be
there. From
the
Chevy stand?
No.
Why not? Oh, you doing it with somebody else?
We have a different sponsor for that.
I have not been informed, so, I don't know.
All right, that's okay.
It's going to be the same place we were last year.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. Daniel says, will we see the names El Dorado or Riviera ever come back? He says, I don't like the alphanumeric names.
Well, we talk about this a lot, and I would say we are married to the alphanumeric. That's something I have no interest in changing that. We've built equity now, right? And to go back and forth, that doesn't do us any good. We don't have a lot of money to spend to go compete against the 3 Series anyway. To go changing names doesn't make sense to me. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't have some special names or things like that come from time to time. We have an Escalade that's been, it's grandfathered into this situation. I'm not going to change that either. So does it have a place for something like that? Who knows? Some today down the road, we're not going to close the door on that. Those particular names, not sure. You know, one of the things I will tell you is it's time for these brands to move forward and make their own name and make their own story. So not necessarily having to borrow equity from an older name. Maybe it's time for us to look at new names. We did with the Sonic. I think it's worked well. We do some namings around the world. We're doing well. Mm-hmm. So I'm not closing the door on those names. I'm just saying we're not necessarily looking.
Our friend Nina Beckhart in the naming group helped Joel with that.
Nina is fantastic, by the way. She's been a great asset to us and turns things over fast. And she came up, Sonic was hers.
Right.
Spin is another one, which was slightly controversial. You name a car Spin, and it's about a family taking their car out for, their family out for a spin. Some people take it literally. Is the car going to spin?
Reading way too much.
And then we've had that, and we've successfully launched it as the correct way. We're going to take the family for a spin. That was one of hers, and that it's tested unbelievably. So, and there's others that she's done with.
Yeah, DeSoto Adventurer says Vauxhall doesn't get Manchester United sponsorship.
No. So Vauxhall has an opportunity for their own sponsorships, and they're looking at it. But this was a bigger thing. When we start looking at Chevrolet is our big global brand. When you tie yourself to the biggest sports franchise, you're going to tie your biggest brand to that. But there are wonderful opportunities for Vauxhall, and we're talking to some clubs about that. And add on to that, so is Opel. And Opel is going to make an announcement shortly, and I don't want to spoil their fun, but they're going to have an announcement too. So we look at these opportunities very strategically, and they're a big play for all of our brands.
Jay Cujo says, I'm not sure I agree with him on this. He says, you see, Ford advertised the Mustang all the time and touting the fuel economy, but nothing for the Camaro. Also, where are ads for the Cruze and Equinox?
We actually have a pretty good plan for the Camaro. We're very targeted about how we do it, and we've done some fantastic work. We did some big ads during the Super Bowl for Camaro. If you don't remember, Miss Evelyn, still one of our more popular ads ever. We get a lot of requests to bring her back. We did the Transformer ad, which was pretty big. And those continue to run from time to time. So we do things with the Camaro. And quite frankly, we're doing quite well with the Camaro. That's not a car that needs a lot of advertising right now. Okay. We're in a dogfight, obviously, with the Cruze. And that does need more advertising. And we talk about how we do more with that constantly.
That's a great car.
The Equinox actually is doing quite well, but we're in a dogfight. And that is an example of that this company can actually build cars in that category, go compete with the Japanese head-to-head, and that's an exciting thing. But that's a very competitive segment, and we need to do more with the Cruze.
With the Cruze,
With the Cruze, doubt about it.
Rum and Coke wants to know, can the Corvette be effectively marketed as a sports car outside of North America?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of interest when we get to the thing we don't talk about.
That they're going to show in Detroit.
But there's a lot of interest in that car as being around the world. We know we could do a better job and project that car around the world because it's a world-class supercar. No doubt we'll do much more with that.
The best way the best way to see the impact of the Corvette is to see it at Le Mans.
Yeah.
See the spectators react to Corvette and Corvette racing. It's a huge draw at Le Mans.
And it goes back, decades. Yeah. We've been going there since the 60s and been successfully there since.
But especially in the last decade, the last dozen years,
yeah.
Corvette's been there every year, And I think competing. That's why
competing
and winning, you know, 7 out of 12 or whatever it is.
Even when we didn't, competing head-to-head with the best of the
right.
best.
Right. And see, I think that's why the people who go to the 24 Hours of Le Mans really like the Corvette, because it wasn't a flash in the pan in there year in, year out. And, you know, it doesn't sound like anything else on the track. I mean, it is so distinctive.
What a great sound.
Yeah. It is.
It's a lot of fun to go to those races.
Hey, we've got a lot more questions. I've tried to just pull the ones out that were directed right at you, Joel, since we've got you here. So I apologize to the others. We're not going to be able to get to them right now because we promised him we'd get them out of here within the hour. And we're at the top of the hour right now. So,
hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No, this is,
this is always fun. This is always fun. And
you guys do
good work. Keep it up. We need stuff like this in this industry. We don't do enough of this, right? This kind of conversation.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's
where do guys like us go to, you know, there's not much anymore for us to do. So this is great. So thank you for doing it.
Cool. Great having you. Peter, great to be back in the saddle with you, so to speak, man.
Yeah,
so,
glad to be back.
And folks, next week we're going to Bob Lutz's farm. So Peter and I are going to be out in the garage with Bob. Tune in for that one.
He's smoking cigars?
If he doesn't object to it, he probably doesn't want us to burn down his garage.
Oh,
but
he smokes out there all the time. It's not a problem.
Okay,
That's where he has to go.
And we'll be smoking cigars next week. You bet we will.
He's a great guy.
Okay, cool. Thanks so much for watching, everybody. It's been great having you here.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.